This is PPD. You guys are watching Thorin's YouTube channel. One of the only men with a bigger ego than even myself.
Even though the Fighting Pandas team largely, I mean, sadly, this was also like in the period when everything went online and it was all those like bullshit regional tournaments.
Yeah.
Even so, you had one good run at that ESL Birmingham tournament. Like in this time period, like it was fucking murking people. I think this was pretty good.
Yeah, I think we had Skitter and Kazu came in. Like Envy and Snay left to C9.
Right.
And then we had Skitter and Kazu came in. And yeah, no, bringing in the Europeans was good because NA Dota is not good. So we brought in the Europeans and we did all right. Like we did probably better than we should have at a lot of these tournaments. And then we signed with like Crazy. And they were actually a pretty good org, I felt. Like how they were talking to us, how they took care of us, how they did their media. And then COVID hit, so they shut down. So that's a rough life. And then after COVID was where... I guess the beginning of the Fighting Pandas team was sort of serious. But I think after COVID hit, that's when like it became a lot. Like people weren't taking on the same level.
It removed a lot of people's motivation because it wasn't landing.
Yeah, I mean, I know for me personally, when COVID started, like... I didn't really enjoy playing the game that much because I don't like playing pubs in NA that much. And COVID hit, so there would be no LANs. You just play these online tournaments versus these NA teams that it was sort of boring, lame, you know? And like the team sort of just fizzled out, I think, from there. I think a lot of it was just like COVID. Like, and also the other thing was me and Moon, like, where we are like sort of leaders on the team and we have very opposite ideas of the game actually. The best, I don't know if you understand, but like I wanted to play a lot like Secret in 2019. He wanted to sort of play like OG. And there's just like two different opposing philosophies in Dota. And both, I think both can work, but you can't have like your two leaders wanting to play.
Why were you favoring that style? Give us a breakdown of what you liked about it.
So Secret style is to play off a lot of vision and farm a lot of the map and out efficiency your opponent. And you use the vision to get your timing and attack them with it. And OG style is you get your timing or even before your timing and you run your opponent and you make mistakes. And you make them make mistakes.
Right.
And they're sort of like opposing dichotomies, which is the problem with like us following these two things. Like for example, like Tundra, I think we play a lot like the 2019 Secret. But I think like it's not like one style is supposed to be better than another. It's just two different ways of looking at the game. So, and then, you know, we have a lot of disagreements about that, and it just wasn't that fun playing, and the team eventually just, you know, just sort of burnt out.
I'll even admit myself, mate, this is probably the period of your career I've watched the absolute least of, because unsurprisingly, like, if I even watched Dota, I was only watching the fucking European one. That was, if people don't know, when Secret was just god mode and they was winning everything. So, right, I didn't watch this very much, but when I looked it up, it seems like you are always losing to all your old fucking teammates when they're in that Quincy crew. Was all
of course.
They would beat you every time, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, they were very dominant in that online period. You would have, like, EG, they played a few tournaments with a mid-stand in for Abid, but... I think they didn't really like playing online. They had like Bulba and Abbott playing or something, or Bulba and like Ryoya playing, two stand-ins. So then Quincy was like the only two good NA teams back then, right? You had EG and you had Quincy Crew. And so if EG weren't really playing, then Quincy Crew would just win it. So that's how the team was. And then because like the only other NA LAN, the LA Major, got canceled due to COVID, and the team was just sort of depression. So. It is what it is, you know?
You talked a little bit before about SVG and saying he was like a really good captain. What about those other two then, MSS and Yawa, who obviously you played with and coached and all this? Like, who were these guys as players?
Yawa's a really, like, he's Sumail's brother, I don't know if you know, but he's a really intuitive player. Like, his understanding is really good, but he often won't be able to vocalize it as well as he should.
Right.
But I really like, he has a really good idea of when to join fights and, like, when to farm. MSS might be the fastest learner I've played Dota with, actually. And I think his results do not display who he is as a player.
Oh, he's actually like an underrated player.
I mean, it's weird because he's always been seen as like a really good player on the teams he's played in, but he's never ended up achieving these results.
Yes.
But the thing, MSS and Yawara, I think the best things about them are actually like their atmosphere for the team. Like, they're really good teammates, I think. They're really funny. They're really engaging. They make the team feel good. And for example, that thing about like pulling melee creeps onto the rage creep, some lane tech that we found on NP or I guess Envy found it, like, MSS was by far the first person to pick this up. Like, you would tell this guy something, sort of same for UR, honestly. Like, just very talented, and the next game, they would just start doing it. Like, it's never been like that for me. I don't know if it's a talent thing, but, like, I would have to, like, grind it out, make myself think about it, try to explain myself the ways it's good. They just would just intuitively do it. Once they, like, if they think it's good, they'll just start doing it. So that's sort of what they are like as players. And, yeah.
Obviously, this was the year where, sadly, there was no TI. Like, we just found out one day, like, the most depressing news of all time. There's no TI, which also, by the way, just as someone who's, like, views himself as a historian, and also I've got, like, a little bit of OCD, it does trigger me now that, like, the years are off, because, you know, before the year was perfect, wasn't it? You could always remember which TI it was. Yeah, it was awesome. Whereas now that's fucked, isn't it? Because it's off by 1 year, right? When you found this out... Yeah, go on.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. Oh, my life history... I just use TI as a reference.
There you go, exactly. Right. Yes, yes.
Oh, it's going to be different. Like, yes. I think in a few years, I'll start getting mixed up. Like, yes. it'll mess up my life. Also, COVID was like a dead period. Like, I don't know what happened during those years. They just sort of disappeared, right? So,
well, look, the question I was going to have was, when this news hit, like, there's no TI, because at the time, people have to remember, this is 2020. No one knew how long this was going to last. I mean, even in 2021, it looked at a point like, are we properly getting lands back, or is it just every now and then there'll be a land? Like, did you ever think at this period of time, maybe Dota's over for me? Maybe it's not even worth playing if it's just online shit.
I mean, I stopped playing for a long time during COVID. Like, I stopped playing before the first DPC. For me, like, at the time, I started just looking for things that interested me. So there are three options for me, right? Because I have no life skills, because I played Dota for 10 years. I could coach, I could play, or I could cast. And I tried coaching and playing, and I wanted to try casting, because I had done some, like, informal casts in the past where, like, you know, you just bring a player, come panel, blah, blah, blah. So that year, I just did some casting, I guess. After, like, I did nothing but, like, degenerate random games for, like, 6 months with some friends. Whereas, you know, you stay up till 7 a.m., you play some games. Your life does nothing. You're not doing anything, but it was fun. It was a good way to decompress. I think that was also like the first real break I've had in Dota. So that really helped me mentally, I think. I think for like the past like 10 years or whatever before that, like I just grinded out games from StarCraft to Dota, and then that was just my entire life. And I think it helped me recover a lot mentally and put me in a good headspace to become like a caster.
Right, the cool thing about your story is we can actually, like you're saying here, I can segue into talking a bit about the broadcast part, and then we'll go into this run where you win TI and you come back as the coach. So one thing I thought was quite interesting when you became a broadcaster is, as you said, yeah, you've done it in the past where you're on like the Kiev Major or whatever, where you're on the desk. But one thing I've noticed is this, right? Players and fans sort of trick themselves when a player goes on the desk, because at the time, everyone's just so excited, so novel. Like, I think this happened to PPD, mate. I know him a little bit, so I know this is true, right? When you're just the player coming on, because it's so cool that you're on the desk, and now you're giving like secret insights that no one gets this info except, and obviously you're like potentially like giving interesting comments. Everyone's just going to tell you you're awesome the first time you do it. They're going to go, oh, it's fucking get him back on. But that's also because it's just like a one-off thing. And so I know when PPD went to do it, he thought it was going to be great, like everyone's saying, like they all want me on the desk. But he said, first of all, like, the first thing you do, especially if you're like majors or fucking TI, is the whole time you are just going in the back of your head like, fuck, I should be playing, that should be me. Like, ah, yeah, great analysis to get, but in your head you're just like, I wish that was me. Like, it's actually not satisfying if you're a former player. And then the other thing is as well, once you do it like more than one event, you did like three or four big lands, like when you do the big lands, you have to just become talent at that point in time. You're no longer just the player. Like, now you get judged on like your skills. Like, are you as good as fucking Malini and all those guys, like the guys who've done it, like the god tier guys? Like, then it is just a different ball game, right? It's a different skill set.
Yeah, I think it is hard. Like, when, as you said, when you first come on, like, if you just talk about the game compared to analysts, you're going to be a lot better at it because you actually played and interacted with the pro scene, and it's very easy to just talk about the game. But then it becomes, I think for myself, I started to learn a lot. Like, it's not just about what you're saying. You have to tell a story with it. You have to present things well. You have to, you know, make sure the flow is going well, stuff like this. And I did a lot of like online tournaments because I think a lot of qualifiers were online. So there's only like, there's a Singapore major into the Anna major into TI. Those were only three lands, and none of them had crowds so that year because of COVID. So I actually never really got to do the casting thing in front of a crowd or analyst thing.
Right.
But I think you pretty much nailed it. Like, you start to like having to develop new skills, which I think is good. Like, I think you need some element of learning or chaos in your life where you get really like stir crazy and bored. But I really enjoyed casting, to be honest. I thought it was really fun. Casting and analysis panel stuff.
Right, when you came to this team now then, when you coached the Tundra team, give me the perspective, how did this happen? Where did this offer come from? Was this also from players? Did they all bring you in? How did you get into this squad?
No, so I had played with Skidder and Fada before, and I hadn't played with, and Snail, of course, and I hadn't played with...
33 and Saxa.
Yeah, 30, no, it was 9. 9 and 30.
Oh, 9.
So we actually changed out Fada for Saxa at some point.
Of course, yes.
So I think a lot earlier in the year, probably around January, Fada had approached me about coaching the team, or maybe even December. And I said, no, I don't want to coach yet. I just want to chill, recover mentally. This is my break. And then I started helping out the team, not really coaching, but sometimes I would go in lobbies to watch replays with them, a couple months before their TI run, their TI qualifier run, where they eventually lost to OG in the finals. And then coming into the new year, I talked with more of the players, got to know them a lot more, and I decided between continuing to cast or coach them. And I decided to coach them because I felt like it was a bit more rewarding than casting and doing analyst panels for me personally. I just felt, I don't know, there's just a competition spark, that you can't get from being an analyst or casting. And the level of involvement was just not high enough for myself. I think commentary and stuff, it's really chill compared to playing and coaching. And I wanted something a bit more involved. So I decided to... I had already had that previous relationship with them. I had worked with three of them on teams before, so it was easy for me to come slot in as coach. I think it's weird because in Dota, I feel like it's very hard to coach a team unless you have previous relationships with the players. But maybe that's because I've only done coaching having those previous relationships, but you need, either you need people to understand you or trust you well, or you need to have a lot of credentials to make them trust you. And it's not easy to do it without either of those.
So do you think that is a key part of being a coach, that you already knew the players before as well? If I gave you just five different random players, even if they were really good, would it be harder for you? You think it's better if you have the past relationship?
I mean, the thing is, I've never tried it, so I don't really know. But I think it makes it infinitely easier because you already know how some people like to play or operate. But if you all come in, I think it would be really hard if you went into coach five players who are already playing together, that they had a relationship and you weren't a part of it. Because then they would have some team dynamic you wouldn't be aware of, and then it would be hard to break into that and sort of have your impact there.
Right, I want to ask about some of the players on this team, and then let's obviously talk about TI itself. So one of the players is the one you referenced before, who apparently you were trying out on the NP era, which was obviously Saxa. So everyone remembers in the other Digital Chaos when he had the epic run, but that was 6 years ago. There's a lot of years where this guy was he was just in the scene. He wasn't in the top teams. How would you explain how has he evolved over the years? He's obviously changed position a few times.
I think he's only played 4 and 5. He played carry before TI6, I think. And he switched to support that year, and he got second. So that was a good transition for him. But I think he switched from 5 from 4, but he was sort of on high-tier teams. He was on teams that were supposed to do well. He stayed on that DC roster for a while. They became Thunderbirds or something. And then they lost to us in qualifiers when we were on C9. And then I think he played on the OG rosters and stuff once Anna left and stuff. Or Jerix retired. He played there, and he was always a super high leaderboards player. He had 3 accounts in the top 10 as a support player, which is sort of unheard of back then. Saxa, he's very stoic. He's very easy to work with. And when he talks, everyone would just shut up and listen to him. He's very trustworthy like that. And I don't know. I always feel like he's just always doing the right thing at the right time. And it's not luck. When you talk to him about the game, he'll explain why he was doing stuff and why it feels right. And he's always the first person to say whether... when we're watching replays, if something just felt wrong. He can always just say, I don't like it. I don't know why, I just don't like it. And usually when someone has one of those feelings on our team, we're okay, let's explore it. And figure out why. And that's usually what leads to the best conclusions for us, is someone has a feeling about something and you actively try to explore why they have that.
It's interesting you say he's a bit stoic, because that was the thing I was also going to ask, is It's a long, a lot of years between like the absolute highs of his career. Like, you must, it's a lot of people wouldn't be able to handle that. Like, if people don't know, if someone's just a fan and they've never played the game, right? I always say, like, the players are in the moment every time they win or lose. Like, they can't be thinking about 3 months from now or what was going on 6 months in the past. So actually, losses can be brutal when they rack up in the game, and especially if you're in teams where, like you say, it's a top ranked team, but then they don't have the big placing at the biggest lands you're supposed to. Like, that'll crush a lot of people's spirit. Like, this guy kept going years until he got his big glory at the end.
Yeah, I think after at the after party, he talked to Suns fan, who was the team owner of DC when he got second. Yes. He's like, "Oh, it's taken 6 years, but I finally did it," and like it was a really happy moment for them, because the thing with Sox was like, it's been so long, but he's never stopped really grinding. Like, he's always been high ranked on the leaderboards. He's always put the work in, and that's the thing about Dota. Like, when it's just about what, like, only one team can win TI, right? Like, it's five players. That's not a lot of players in the scene who are winning. Especially when OG takes two. So, I don't know, even if you're grinding at the top, you might not find that success.
And then I've got to ask, you've got to tell me something about Nine, because this is a player where, like, look, I know there have been a lot of, like, surprise winners of TI and teams that did a great role. Like, if you just went on paper a few years ago and I put a list of names, I'm like, right, which of these players is going to win TI? Then? I don't think he's going to be making many people shortlist. Like, this is a pretty surprising performance for me.
Yeah, I think Nine, he improved a lot over time. And I think, like, a while ago, like, not even as recently, he was, like, ranked one of the leaderboards a lot. I think when MMR first came out and Miracle was, like, the first to get 7K or something, Nine was actually ranked 2 back then. And he had some, like, personal struggles, so he didn't, like, compete as much back then. But I think when I came onto the team, he was already, like, a really good teammate. He was easy to work with. He would try to help his teammates. He would, like, directly talk to people about problems if he thought they had them and try to address them and help them. And the thing that he struggled with over the years, I think he had, like, a lot of, maybe not imposter syndrome, but to that level, but, like, a lot of self-doubt and whether he could, like, do things. And he worked on his mental game a lot. And, yeah, I don't know. Nine is a really easy player to work with on a team.
You know, on that line of what you're talking about there, people, when they have the imposter syndrome, and obviously we discussed earlier, like, bringing in sports psychologists and stuff, I often think that's an element that a lot of fans miss as well. It's like, I know a lot of, like, the really great star players, sometimes they can come off as very arrogant, etc. Like, as fucked up as this sounds, are we? Like, I sort of want my star player to think he's the absolute best, that he's going to shit on the other guy. Like, it's way hard. I always say, when you have the player who's really good, but they doubt themselves, I can fix something in the game if we've got a problem, but like, I can't, we have to bring it outside. People have to have sports psychologists. We have to start going through, get on the fucking couch. What do you think the problem is? You know, that's fucking really difficult to fix, like the performance anxiety or whatever people have, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think a lot of times it's like more deeply seated than like some mechanic performance, right?
Yes.
And I sometimes if I don't really know how it works, the brain stuff is a lot of mystery to me, but I think it's always there. Like, even for, like, sometimes, like, the arrogance for the top players, like, it's a cover for their insecurities, right? Like, it's always biting at them, like, oh, what if I fall off? What if this is my last good tournament? What if, like, you know? Like, you'll always have these, like, negative thoughts in the back of your mind. It's about, like, channeling them well and using them well or whatever to propel yourself into your best form mentally. And I think Nine got really good at that. So that was, I think that's why he improved so much as a player. And I don't know, he sort of came out of nowhere, but he's also a player that's been grinding for a long time, right? And that's just how it goes in Dota. Like, even someone like Nisha, who, like, he exploded onto the scene with Secret, but he was on some, like, random team before that. Like, you look at his Wikipedia, or Liquipedia, he was on some team called, like, Just Do It, like, five times or something, alternating between random teams, and then he got picked up by Secret, and boom, he's amazing. I think there's a lot of, there's probably a lot of unexplored talent like that, where if you slot them into a good team in the right environment, they could really shine, but they don't have that opportunity because it's not easy. It's not easy to get the opportunity. It's not easy to make it.
By the way, another thing I've noticed in Dota, I want to get your take on it. I'll just ask it in a very naive way. I know, true, we've already discussed that TI results can be very varied compared to the rest of the year, but like, Dota seems like the worst game for like the best player in the world getting to win the world championship, if you know what I mean. Like, the amount of times in the year, either the best team or the best player just doesn't win. And combined with that, I notice, because players, as you say, still have a lot of power over whether people get kicked in the lineups, the people have made so many star players, superstar teams and all-star teams and fucking, and people have seen people like Miracle and Arteezy and Samil. They pretty much for many, many years have sort of like dictated the whole scene, like what they want to do and who they want to play with. But if you notice, like they, in the normal circuit, these are really good players, so they're going to get their results. They're going to get their finishes and their championships. But in terms of TI results, like TI seems like the most fickle tournament for these stars I've ever seen in esports.
I mean, sort of, but like Samil and Miracle did win a TI, right?
They did, but I mean, like, put it this way: if you started Dota over and you think of all the talents, yeah. You think these guys would win like three or four each? You know, like these are the god talents. They've had like 5-6 years of the best. Like, dude, the Arteezy one. I have to describe this to people in other games who don't know Dota because they've heard like the meme of like, haha, he never wins TI, and I'm like, no, you have to understand, yeah. He is fucking unbelievably good, and he's like, forget TIs, he'd be like a top 10 player of all time, probably top 5. Let's be real, like he has been unbelievably good year after year after year. So when you try to explain to people why he doesn't win, you have to go into all these, like, maybe the meta was off, or his team peaked too early, or who the fuck knows, right? But it's like, you would sort of on paper naively expect that the best players would just win a lot more, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess it is weird. Like, but I think the best players do have good finishes at TI. They just end up, like, not always winning, right? Like, Arteezy had third, I think, on EG.
Oh, he had loads, yeah.
2014, yeah. But, for example, like, Zai, I think Zai's probably... Like, Zai's had, like, third, like, 4 times or something. Like, something ridiculous.
Do you think... let me ask you this, then.
I don't know.
should it be a bit like... I don't know if you know this, but in card games, uh-huh. like Magic the Gathering and Hearthstone, because of the card element means there's a lot more variance. In those games, you actually count, like, top eights instead of, like, the championship, because the premise is if you're good, you're going to just generally make top eight at the tournament more often. That's how you count.
I
feel almost like it should be like that. That's what you're saying here. Because actually, that's a good counterpoint. If I look at it, if I do get these two godlike players, man, they have a lot of top fours, and they are going to finish, like, top six of many, many, many years, whether they win or lose, right? So you can't always determine the meta. I guess that does show that over history they were the best players.
Yeah, I think it's like that. I think for me personally, it's like how I define tier one team is that I think tier one teams are teams that have a shot at winning the tournament but will consistently place high, and right. Tier one teams will always like defeat the tier two teams basically.
Yes,
like the consistency is what makes these players great or like or a tier one or whatever, you know. So I think they are consistent. Like, I don't know. Winning TI is so weird. Like, you're right. Like, I think a lot of the greats that you expect to have... Like, honestly, it's so ridiculous that Poppy hasn't won an RTI, right?
Mad,
with
it?
All his TI results, right? Like, he won the first one, which was, like... I think even he would say it's not really the same as the later TIs, right? Oh, like, the format's different and, like...
And no one played the game.
Yeah, nobody played the game. It's like, people, I think a lot of the Chinese pros during the first TI, they didn't even think it was a real game.
Exactly.
Right?
Didn't attend, Dota 1, right? Yes, exactly.
Yeah. A lot of them didn't attend from Dota 1. So yeah, I don't know. Like, when that's why I also think like winning TI is a lot about luck and sort of a crapshoot. Like, it's, and I think you're right. Like, in Dota, it's not always the best team that wins the tournament. It's like we talked about before, but maybe some team gets a meta advantage or they guess right under preparation, because you're just guessing when you play these scrims. You're guessing that the strategies you're winning with are actually good strategies. It's an educated guess, but you're still like not 100% certain. For example, like the Stockholm Major, like OG ended up winning that one, but I thought we were the best team there. We just sort of mentally choked at the end. And it just happens like that. Like, that's just how it goes. Like, at TI8, like, the reason why I got called Fluke TI was because everyone thought LGD was the best team, even though OG won.
Yes.
Which, honestly, in hindsight, is probably fair. Like, it's not like OG were undeserving or anything, but LGD were, like...
Even the way they played in the tournament, dude. Like, those two games they lost to OG, like, those might be some of the best games ever played, even though they lost. Like,
for sure.
Wasn't it?
I mean, how they lost was insane. Like, added, like, sells an item, you know? Like, just, you know... And, like, obviously he deserves credit for that, but it's also, sure. like, sort of luck that you think of that. Yes. You have this idea, right? Like, yes. You deserve credit for that, for the greatness, but another day you might not think of that, you know? Like, yes. One other day, you know, you might have slept 30 minutes too little and you don't perform, and that's just what happens at TI. One day of bad sleep and you're out of the tournament. Like, that's rough, you know? Like, you worked your entire life for this.
Sure.
So, and I think also the other thing with the great players is there's also so much more pressure on them, right? Like, I feel like I can't say for Arteezy, but like when he goes into TI or Valve events, I feel like he feels insane pressure. See, yes. You know, he got second those two majors. Everyone's like, this is Arteezy's year. They start getting 9th to 12th at that TI. They come into this TI. They're like not performing that well. Oh, we have a good group stage. We have some hope. And then they sort of bomb out of the... Like my friend said that the SAT beat them so hard that they stole their sponsor, which I thought was really funny. So yeah, that's so a good one. It's just like a lot of pressure, and there's a lot of factors that go in outside of like your individual play and mechanical prowess in Dota.
Even though, as you said, like obviously you'd even had like Skitter before, but this is another player where if I said to someone, this is going to be the carry position player of a TI winning team, they would say bullshit.
Yeah, I think the public perception was even like a few months before TI, like people didn't rate Skitter that highly, but like from the inside, like he's a really important player for our team. I think Skitter might actually, I think overall Snape probably talks the most, but Skitter is probably second. And I think he makes a lot of the most important calls for us that we play around his hero. And I think it's been like that a lot, but Skitter has put the work in. He's grinded for so long. He even went to like South America when South America wasn't considered that strong a region, just because he wanted to grind it all and keep playing, keep getting better. And I think like he's always had this passion and fire. And it's actually something I'm a bit worried about now that he's won TI. Like, I hope he keeps that passion and fire so we can continue. But like, I think that's what's always enabled Skitter. And he's like, he's constantly watching replays of other carry players. It doesn't matter if he thinks he's better than someone or worse than someone. He'll watch the replays, see if there's something he can learn from. So that's Skitter.
It's funny you said that you actually thought, like, for example, at like the Stockholm tournament, you guys should have won or whatever. Because in this team, right, the first run you had, again, you were so close. This team could have won championships before TI, like that Gamers Galaxy tournament. Like, you already beat the fucking Boom team that you had to play in the final, and even then, like, what a ridiculous final to lose. Like, this team, your team was the best. At that tournament, your team was probably the best team, right?
Yeah, probably. Unlucky. I don't know. It's just how it goes. I think it really revealed to us. Like, I'm glad we lost those tournaments so we could end up winning TI. I feel like if we didn't lose those tournaments, we probably wouldn't have won this TI because we wouldn't have been so aware of our weaknesses on the mental side. And it's like, so I have this like theory that like when you're learning, or it's a theory I read online, I guess, when you're learning stuff, like you get worse at other stuff because you're so focused on learning, right? So we bought into sports psychologists, all this mental side stuff. We focused on so much that we ended up playing really bad at Arlington and Riyadh. But if that didn't happen at the correct timeline for Stockholm, where we're like, oh, we have this mental weakness, we need to focus and learn that. Oh, even though we're performing badly, we still need to get this right in order to get it right for TI. We probably wouldn't have won TI. And that's why it's such a luck thing, right? Like, there's a chance that, like, maybe if OG had lost that Stockholm Major, maybe they went through the same things that we did at the time, they would have improved into a TI-winning team for TI 11.
Yes.
And it's just so much luck, and that's also contributing why, like, these all-time greats, like, maybe you don't win the tournament because you don't get lucky enough, but you still do place highly.
Yeah, by the way, as an aside, that's the one area, as much as like in CSGO, we're all mega jealous of all the crowdfunding of TI and all that stuff. The one thing I actually do think is brutal about Dota compared to CSGO is in CSGO, like we have two majors a year. So like you still have to peak for the major, but you get two cracks at it. Whereas like I've always thought the worst feeling in the world in Dota, it's like what you were describing there, is when you're the best team in the world in spring and it's like, oh, there's no way this is going to last till fucking TI. Like, it's just too long, isn't it? Like, we'd have to be the greatest team of all time probably to win TI after that.
And there's even like the thing that makes me feel the worst is the year we didn't have TI, you had Secret win like all the online tournaments, like seven turns in a row. They were by far the best team.
Yes.
And like, they just didn't get to play TI, and it's just, what can you do? You know, I'm lucky. Yes.
I even feel like, no joke, even though you guys won, so obviously great for you, I feel like in that lower bracket run, everyone wanted Secret to win for exactly that reason. It was like Poppy to win TI, Mission to get his TI. Like, that was the story. That was the narrative.
Yeah, same for Liquid, right? Because they had the Matsu storyline. Yes. I feel like the thing that this TI lacked the most was, like, I don't know how much of TI you watch, but they had, like, the rotational stages and group stage. So, like, there was, like, 5 minutes downtime between games. It was really fast, which is really good for the players. Yeah. But it didn't leave any time for content, and we didn't really like film anything before the group stage and stuff. So there wasn't any real good storyline, because the panel didn't get to make one. They didn't have enough time. There weren't a lot of interviews. So the only storylines going to TI were like the pre-existing ones. I feel like people didn't really like get a chance to know our team and cheer for us during the tournament. And Liquid and Secret are way more popular teams, so, you know, and they had better storylines going to TI, so I feel like no one cheered for us until the very finals, like game three, you know? Like, sure. No one was like, because, and I don't blame them. It's just like how it was presented itself, right?
Sure. I mean, that was also the other thing. It's like, I wonder when you were at TI, because as you say, like, it'll depend on like the scrim groups and stuff before when you're in the group stage. When do you think the other teams actually realized, like, oh no, your team's for real? Because in the circuit, like I said, it was good early on, but then the tournaments coming into TI were terrible for your team. Like, the joke is, you were on the fucking desk more than the team was in the tournament for the ones before TI. So, like,
yeah.
When do you think it actually clicked for the other teams in the tournament that you were actually for real at this TI?
I think all the teams knew were. Because we play scrims for some. Like, our scrim win rate was always very good on this team.
Ah, right. Okay.
So, and Dota, like you basically will scrim most teams. Like, there's very few, like, maybe if you have some, like, rivalry with a team, you won't scrim them, but you'll pretty much scrim everyone. But I think the public perception, like, I saw, like, some power rankings that had us last, which is sort of insane. Like, yeah, we had a bad tournament in Argentina, but we had a stand-in in Saudi. We did really well in Dubai. We did really well in Stockholm. We won the last Europe DPC, which was, like, the hardest DPC. So I think the teams didn't really underrate us. It was just like some Reddit perception.
Right, I see. Okay. Right, in this actual tournament then, another thing about Tundra I've noticed is when you're doing well, it always even usually manifests in the group stage. But this group stage was a bit fucking sauce, right? It was like...
This group stage?
No, I mean, as in like yours was like the one where the other one was the one where they dominated Super. Like you were like losing and winning games. It was back. You finished first, but it was like you were still giving up games, right? So did you actually feel in the group stage like we're hitting our peak, we're going to win?
I mean, the first couple of days, I think we started the tournament like 3-3, right? Which was sort of below our expectations. But I think, again, like, as a luck factor, like, you sort of want to lose early if right. you need to be exposed, right? So expose some weaknesses in our play we could fix. And then, like, no one's going to say it, like, oh, guys, I think we're going to win. But, like, as the group stage started ramping up, as we started getting into a stride, like, I think people are starting to feel it. Like, especially, like, as, like, the main stage went on, like, the game, like, after the OG series especially, like, I think people are really feeling it. But... I don't know if it's like a superstition. I think it's more like you don't want to set such high expectations of yourselves, but Dota players don't like you can't say you're going to win, right? I think it's the same as sports.
Okay.
Like you can't say, oh, we're going to win.
I mean, it's sort of true. Like, if people don't know, like, the famous one in hockey is you're not supposed to ever touch, like, the conference championship trophy. You're supposed to, like, utilize it, like, curse you and you don't win the fucking Stanley Cup or whatever. Like, people are super superstitious about that shit. But that's actually a weird thing maybe a fan wouldn't know. For players, it's not about, like, it's like the vibe, right? It's like you don't want to sort of, like, get ahead of yourself or, like, feel uncomfortable with the idea, right?
It's also about, like, your mental approach to the game. Because if you go into the game with expectations of win or just trying to win, I feel like you're going to rush things. You're not going to do your fundamentals properly. You're not going to think about the game straight. Like, you're just thinking, oh, I need to win. And you start to rush the game. It's not good. And it's the same, like, we did these, like, roundtable interviews at TI after finishing top four. There was, like, a long break due to some logistical reasons. And they would kept asking us stuff like, oh, how does it feel to play in the finals against? Like, they would ask you for each team. Like, how does it feel? And, like, we had a lot of struggle with that because mentally, we don't want to think about winning the tournament. We want to think about, hey, this is the hard work we put in. Here's the steps we took that led us to be successful. Let's keep doing these steps. Let's keep working on our fundamentals. Keep our rhythm going. And I think that probably, like, that focus of ours on making sure we weren't thinking of that was really beneficial to us throughout the tournament.
Right. Another thing I wanted to ask about with this one is, right, in general, another thing I've noticed about TI, because obviously a unique quality compared to like CSGO Major, League of Legends, they're all single elim tournaments if people don't know. So like in those tournaments, there's one way you win. You just have to be the best team and you have to never lose.
Is CSGO
like,
single elim too?
It's still single elim, believe it or not. Yeah. Isn't that crazy? I know, but it is. Who knows why? We could go into a whole fucking side tangent on that. But basically, TI famously is always double elim. And I've noticed, if you want to have a good result, it's an obvious statement, but it's just true. You want to have a really good fucking upper bracket run then, because the problem is that lower bracket is always a bloodbath. And there's always some teams that no one expects to win some mental, like, win 5 series in a row. So your team had the dream run. You were just fucking dusting people off in the upper bracket. Like, that had to feel fucking amazing.
Yeah, I think 33 said this, but I feel like when you watch TI from home, as a player, and you watch these teams with upper bracket, it's like they're playing the tournament cheat codes. Because you win one series, and you're like top 6. Yes. And you win another, you're like top 3. You're like, holy shit, this is so easy, you know? 2 series, top 3 at TI. It is insane. And as you said, like, you don't know who's going to pop up in the lower bracket, right? The thing is, like, at TI, like, you can have a bad loss in the upper bracket, and you end up playing Spirit in the lower bracket at TI 10. Like, OG at TI 10 were probably a really good team.
Sure.
But they just happened to play Spirit, like, in the first round of loser, or second round of loser bracket. Same for, like, you know, you play some Liquid at TI7, they drop down, and then, you're playing the eventual TI champions. You might have been the second best team at the tournament. You just happened to lose to Liquid. or Spirit. So, yeah, no. I mean, I love double elimination. I don't know why other esports don't do it. I think it's super superior. It's better for story. It's better for everything. The only thing I think it's worse for is, like, you're less likely to have an upset, I guess. Like, a hard upset, which is, like, the crowd can cheer for. But, like, this isn't, like, physical sports where you have some time constraints or, like, you can't play two games in a row. I don't know why they don't. It's actually ridiculous to me.
Let me ask you about some of the specific results then. So obviously, I mean, funny thing is, in the upper bracket, you guys had to play a Spirit, and Spirit is one of the top teams in the world, if people don't know.
We played OG in the first round, upper bracket. Spirit was lower bracket. They lost to Boom.
Oh, sorry. Wait, I'm thinking of a different tournament match.
Oh, all good.
I meant OG then.
That was Stockholm.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
It's OG I'm thinking of. That was the team that was like, they were one of the absolute favourites for the whole tournament. Like, on paper, like, this team's supposed to win this match. Like, this must have been a big game.
It was a good big game, especially because there's a big collide between which group's meta is better, right? Because OG's Group A, and you don't know. You don't know if Group A, maybe their Shadow Fiend stuff, maybe all their heroes, maybe it's better than what we're playing in Group B. But it wasn't, so we beat them, you know? And then I think all Group B won, right? I think for the upper bracket for round one. It just showed, like, that meta difference, right? Like, all 14s win, and it's GG for Group A. They all lose. But yeah, that was a big win. I think especially since OG was a team that I think we're 3-3 for some on the year. So it was like a really contested matchup throughout the DPC and tournaments. And we lost them to Stockholm, so we want some revenge. And we managed to beat them here, so we're really happy with that. Also, like, how we beat them, I think the games felt really good from the communication standpoint. Like, we felt really comfortable, even though we're on the stage for TI.
And then when you played the Thunder Awaken team, I mean, it's not really a team you expect to play at that point.
We didn't play Thunder Awaken.
Oh, wait a second. What am I thinking of? Oh, Astra.
You're looking at Stockholm, that's why. That was our role in Stockholm.
Oh, I'm remembering the wrong ones. I mean, that's why. Funny enough, it's the same storyline anyway. It was supposed to be, it was Astra you played next.
Yeah.
And this was another team, like, on paper, they're supposed to be your team. Like, this is a squad that's been pretty good in the DPC.
Astra looked really good coming in. I'm not sure. Like, maybe from an outside perspective, we're supposed to lose them, but I think we felt really confident in all our matches because we get to see our scrims and stuff, right? I think the thing is, like, we had actually scrim Aster, I think, 6 games, and I think we 6-0'd them in scrims, maybe 5-1. I think we 6-0'd them in scrims, so we were really confident coming into the match. And the only problem was that we'd scrimmed them 6 times, and we had actually showed every single one of our strats for some, I think.
Okay.
But, like, or not all of them, but, like, most of them, you know? We had played, like, you had the Arcwood, and we played Verseek in the finals. Like, we had played that a lot versus Aster. We played our Broodmother.
When you play
a
match like that, then how do you decide? Because obviously, part of it might be like try not to do too much that we shown. What you just do what worked in the practice? How do you decide for that match?
I think it's a crapshoot. You just hope for the best. You know, you like look at their heroes. You look at what you think they're weak against. And you look at what you're confident in. And like it's just because we had not played them for a while, right? Like his entire group stage and everything. And we had to watch the matches, see what they're good on. And you sort of guess, and you just see in the draft. You sort of make like a priority list on what strategies you want to go for, what heroes you want to pick, and build off that in the draft. You can't like just pick one strat, like, oh, this is what we want to play versus them. So it just happened to work out. I think one of the games we were really far behind versus Aster, but the cons were really good, which I was really happy with. We ended up winning that game even from 5 or 6k behind in mid-game.
And then obviously Secret was the one you played in the upper bracket and then the final itself, right? If people don't know, despite the fact if you've listened to this interview and you know the old school or don't, you're going to think, it's all Secret, like Poppy and like you said, like Nish and like, that was years ago now, guys. Like this team actually was what they were on some like OG shit of like, how the fuck are they even in TI? Wait a minute. They go to the final. Like no one expected this run. So like when you face a team like that, a question I have is there an element of like, do you almost feel like, fuck, they're just on one this tournament? Like, this is like a miracle run from that. Is there like the vibe of that almost?
I don't know if anyone thought about that. Like maybe they did, but for me, I didn't. I thought they were having a really good run. Obviously, they went through the LCQ. Like they had a really bad year and they went through LCQ. They won that first place and then they got second in the groups. But I think the thing that gave us a lot of confidence against them was that we 2-0'd them in the groups as well. And the games were like relatively smooth. We like won matchups that we probably shouldn't have on some skill difference or like whatever. So I think for us, a lot of our focus on the mental side was just making sure we evaluate stuff accurately and for what it was. We tried to not like let outside influences sort of taint our perception of what our opponent was. So I think we were able to like sort of analyze what we thought a Secret and just play against whatever it is.
Is there an extent to which, because you, like you say, you played them in the groups, then you played them in the bracket final, then you played them in the final, was that actually like a key aspect to winning, that you got that specific opponent in those rounds? Like, for example, if you'd have played like some of the teams you didn't play, I don't know, LGD or something, was there other teams would have been a worse matchup for you?
I think Liquid is the worst matchup for us. Historically, right, we haven't performed that well versus Liquid. I think they beat us in most of the DPCs. They beat us for the Riyadh qualifier. But I'm not too sure. I mean, you can never really say, but I think we would have felt confident going against them anyways. I actually did my prep for Liquid in between the 2 days.
Oh, right, because I hadn't thought of that. Because you have the break. In theory, you don't want to just do nothing. You have to try and like shadow box, like what if we play them or something.
So during the 5-day break, I did my prep on all three teams. Like mainly on
Secret. Oh, right, just went on all of them. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, because there's only four teams, right? So you can just do it on all of them. You have time. But then between after day one of the main event, we played for Secret. They played for Aster. Yeah, so they're a lower bracket, and then the next day you're going to play against either Liquid or Secret, because they played the lower bracket final. So before that day, I actually did my prep versus Liquid, like more prep versus Liquid, because we sort of expected to play them. And then I think that probably would have produced a better finals, but I think how we're playing the tournament, like we probably would end up winning. But who can say?
In theory, no one knows like if these lineups will all ever be in the same tournament again. Can you give me like a? Can you give a little hint as to what you might have done against Liquid? What the game plan would have been?
I mean, I'm going to explain a bit about our styles. Like, I think us in Secret, the reason why it was a 3-0 and the games look so one-sided is because we actually play very similar styles with different farm distribution. Like, 9 takes less farm for us, and Kristalis takes less farm for them, whereas Nisha is more farm and Netta is more farm for us. But how we play the map is very similar. We're very, like, you know, this 2019 Secret, I sort of based a lot of my ideas off. They're still Secret. They still have the same ideas. So, you know, you officially on a map, you use a lot of vision, you wait for your timing, you wait for a good fight, you don't take any fights that you don't like, and you're always trying to be in control. So we sort of play the same style, but we did it better. That's why it ended up being 3-0. But Liquid are like, they're like a very lane-heavy early aggression team. And I think that's the type of style that can sort of break a style like ours. That's why we had trouble with them in the past. Like, once we start messing up, it can sort of snowball. And I think, like, with hindsight, like, I think we are, like, by far the best team at this TI, but how you can beat that is you can throw in some element of chaos. So the chaos would be if they won the early game a bit and they snowballed off it, then even though, like, hypothetically we're, like, better than them in mid-game or late-game or whatever team fighting, it doesn't matter because they're just snowballing the game and causing this chaos. And once we lose one match, maybe we'll snowball our mental game or they'll have a lot of momentum and they could have potentially beaten us that way. But I think our game plan versus Liquid would have been, like, sort of to match the tempo a bit. We would have tried to play a lot faster, played a lot more in the runes, and sort of make sure that they don't have a safe lane that can shut down our off lane. So I think that was Liquid's other strength versus us, is that Matu's a really good laner. So he made it hard for 3-3 to play his game.
Right, obviously, when you win the championship, no one wants to say it was an easy game or a boring game or whatever, but it does feel like things just went almost as well as they could go for your team. Like, if you're in a moment like that TI final, like, the stakes are the greatest, all it takes is you do bad in game one, or you get in a game series where it's like 1-1, 1-1 till the fifth game. Like, it can get really hairy. Then it seems like this has to be almost the dream final.
Yeah, for sure. I think we were, like, prepared to lose games. I think it's mostly what we worked on since we had the failing at Stockholm Major. But, like, the thing about the thing that compounded this, like, that the belief that we would do well even if we lost the game was in the group stage. We lost 3 games in the first game, and then we won the second one, which we were really happy with. Maybe 4 games. Maybe all 4 are lost the first game. And we always came back and won the second one. So we're really happy with that. But, yeah, the games were really straightforward from the audience side, but I think from the player side, like, I think we sort of broke them in the draft in games 1 and 2, because we ended up picking heroes into what they thought were the counters, and we beat them. So it's like the thing I was talking with ATF earlier with, like, the Timbersaw versus counter. Like, we knew this matchup, and they're like, oh, I don't know how to counter it now. So what ended up happening was, like, they had to ban a Naga Siren in game 2, and game 3, they picked it to prevent us from picking it, which is always not somewhere you want to be. And we sort of broke them with that. Same in game 2. What did we do? I can't remember. We had another counter pick that was like, they thought the Beastmaster into the Naga in game 3, and game 2 was something else. But anyways, we sort of broke them with the draft, and it made it hard for them to, like, function in a way that they could surprise us. Because it made their draft very straightforward. If, like, they were, like, so worried about what we were going to do, that made it very telegraphed for us.
Right, obviously, one of the things that Poppy's legendary for is his drafting, though. So is it just your team, do you think, was the counter in some of the ideas you had? Did he have an off day, do you think?
It's like drafting's a lot about the tools that your team can provide, right? Like, if you can play a certain strategy, then, like, and your opponent can't, that's a huge advantage. And if you can beat, like, as I said, like, if you break their idea of the draft and you beat their counters with your heroes, then it doesn't matter how good a drafter are, you don't have the tools to beat the other team at that point in terms of the draft. So I think it was, like, there wasn't much you could do after it started. Like, they had to change their hero pool or, like, learn some new counters to how we played, but it's not easy to do that in Dota. Like, there's not that many scrims in between the break because there's only four teams left. You can only scrim two other teams and they might not even want to scrim that much. And none of the pros are playing pubs because they're out of the tournament. So the pub quality isn't that high and it's really hard to learn new things and be comfortable enough to play with them on the TI stage where, like, you know, for him, like, Crystallis, this is the first TI for sure, like, for most of the, like, Nisha and Zayak, I think it's the first TI finals as well, right? It's, like, not easy to make these players feel comfortable and have a cohesive, robust draft.
Did it bring up any interesting emotions playing against Resolution in a TI final? Well, coaching against them in this case.
Not for me in particular, but I think Saxa had a big dose of the, like, I don't want to lose my, you know, because they lost TI6 together. Right, like, sure. He doesn't want to be the one who got second places, whereas okay. Resolution's the one who wins it, right? Yes. So, yeah, I think there are definitely some emotions going into the game, but I think when TrueSight comes out, people will see, like, our comms were maybe even a bit boring. Like, they're very steady. So I think, like, once the game started, we were able to close off all the outside noise, just make sure we're executing exactly what we want to do.
When you started your coaching journey, as you said, initially it was just like you're standing in one and then you, like, do it when you're not playing or you don't have a team offer. Like, at the time, I'm sure you didn't know, like, this is going to be what I'm going to do for years and years. Do you actually think, does this TI, does it represent the idea that, like, are you the best coach? Are you among the best coaches? Does this cement you in that status? Is this, like, a real thing now?
For sure not the best coach, because my record at TI is not good. Like, or, like, even over, like, the years, my history as coach, this is, like, the first time I've been successful as coach, in my opinion. But I think, I don't know, it's, like, you don't know what coaches do on teams. Like, you don't know their impact, right? Like, I think right now, the best coach, people would say, is probably, because he won in 2017 with Liquid, and he had a lot of success with Secret over the years, and yes, he's, like, very highly regarded. But I don't actually know what he does. Like, I met up with him on vacation when we were in Korea together. Well, he lives there, and I was vacationing there. And, like, we talked a bit, but, like, you don't really know for sure, right? Like, is this coach more of a mental side? Is he more, like, some micro stuff? Does he control the draft? You'll never know. So people online, they'll just fill in some blanks. Like, you know how they always blame Bobo for the draft? Probably not his fault, guys. Probably. Maybe. I don't actually know. It might be his fault. You don't know. But, so it's very hard to, like, empirically stack the coaches, even more than players, I think. So,
without giving away too much, in that case, enlighten us. What is Aoi 2000 like as a coach? What are you doing for the team?
So, I think with my background, my main strength is that when players come with idea or I start an idea, it's very easy for me to understand it and talk to other players in a way that they'll understand about the idea, so we can actually combine it into something for the team. I think what happened in a lot of the past teams that I've worked with is that people have an idea, but won't be presented well enough, or people won't understand it. It sort of gets lost in translation, or even makes the team worse because they're not executing properly. And I think the nice thing about this team is, like, it's very easy for me to get along with everyone, so I can provide this, like, easy third party for conflict. I think those are the two biggest things, like combining ideas and bringing new ideas and solving the conflicts on the team. But really, like, you're all just living together during these games and making sure the environment's good, making sure practice is good, that there's enough non-Dota stuff going on in the team that you don't burn out. You know, just talking with the players.
In your team, how much of the draft is, like, democracy, how it's done?
I think the entire draft is a combination, actually. More than other teams I've been on. I don't think Snay overruled anyone. in the draft, but we have given him the power that, like, if he sees a certain line that he really doesn't like, he wants to do something else, he has the power to do that, but he never felt the need to. He has done it in the past, and I think more often than not, it's ended up very good for us. And we could, especially even if we lose, like, we could learn from it and this disparity in the draft, because that's when you learn, right? Like, when two people have opposing ideas. But other than that, like, it's a lot of people talk about, like, Snay or me will usually provide an idea of what type of hero we want. Like, these are the things the hero needs to cover or what we want from it. And the person who's picking that hero will suggest how they want to approach the hero they're picking. And other people can chime in if they see a really good line, but usually it's like a discussion between me, Snay, and then the players, and we just sort of decide through that.
Does winning TI, in light of some of the like theory crafting we've done about past TIs and why people did or didn't win, does it imply that by the end of the tournament, your team did have the most correct meta read? Was it more like you had the best meta read? Was it just the best meta read for your team? How would you define, like, what was the real reason why your team won TI?
Sorry, I'm going to think for a sec.
It's all good.
For sure, it doesn't prove that we're the best team or that we have the best meta read or anything like this. Like, we can even see it's basically the same patch. Not really. There's some big nerfs, but, like, even on the same patch, there were some heroes that got popular right after TI, even though the tournament... It's always been like this. Like, on the same patch, you'll have some heroes that weren't picked at all that'll just pop up and, like, holy shit, this Imba, why was it not played? Biggest example here is, like, there's some Rikimaru support that people are playing a lot. But I think this TI, I don't know. I don't know if, like, you can take a tournament to prove anything. It just, like, it puts, like, one big point of data that what this team, something that this team did was correct, right, for the tournament. Or maybe multiple things. But you don't really know what those things were. Like, they could have just gotten lucky with what they practiced. It could have been like, oh, their strat was actually not that good, but it just happened to be good during this tournament, and then 1 week later, it actually wouldn't have been good. So I think it's hard to judge stuff as, like, this proved anything.
Right. One of the funny things I thought, because I didn't even realize this myself till your team won, because as you said, the joke is until the end of the final, no one believed your team was going to win. Like, it wasn't the sexy storyline. So the funny thing is, if you remember, what everyone got horny for is that classic storyline from TI, which is like, who's going to be the first one to win two? So it was all like, yeah, oh my God, Poppy. Or it was maybe like, you know, wow, Zai hasn't won a TI yet. It was like, that was the one for Liquid, obviously. And there was like these competing storylines.
Matu would have had two as well.
There you go. But it's only when you won that people realized, he's backdoored it because he did it as a player and a coach. But actually, how he wins the first two, yeah, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, I think Heen would have done if Seeker won two, right? Yes. Like, he had he would have had two as a coach, I guess. But yes. I think it was less people. Like, I think a lot of analysts and people maybe favored us to win the tournament after the top four. But, like, I don't think a lot of teams people were cheering for us because our storyline wasn't just as good. But yeah, that was. I don't know. Even now, like, I feel like the amount of media that has happened is less for this TI than past ones. And I'm not too sure it's like that's to do with like our storyline was less interesting or like whatever it is, but I feel like it's less. Maybe it's just a bias. Not sure.
without hating, I'll just say as an outsider who could be hating on anywhere. Like, as you said earlier, this TI, I'll just be real, it didn't feel as epic like as a tournament as some of the past ones, you know. Especially not the ones pre-COVID and all that jazz. Those ones really felt like huge, you know.
Yeah, I think I've heard that quite a bit. I've even heard, like, some of friends who usually watch TI every year, they didn't even know TI was happening, which is, like, okay, sort of shocking, right?
That's
and,
wild,
like, there was lower viewership, and the tournament was lower prize pool, and there's a lot of factors for that. I don't know. Like, maybe... I think there's also some conscious decisions by Valve to scale back TI a bit, because right, at the end of the day, they're, like, they're not... Like, they're not like Riot, who has a full tournament division, right? Like, they're just a software engineering company. And they just, oh, I want to throw in this tournament. It looks fun. Let's do it. And it grew into something that became, like, maybe more of like, hey, this is not what we want to actually do. So I think they consciously decided to scale it back. But yeah, it feels a bit less fanfare-y than less other TIs for sure.
All the same, though, what is the significance to you personally for your career? I mean, if you think about it, like, we started the interview where you were arguably at your player peak as of your career, and then you went through all the hard times, and you switched over to coaching. What's the significance to win a second TI for you personally?
It's nice. I don't know. Like, I guess it validates a lot of ideas in Dota. Like, it's nice to, like, think about your ideas and be like, I mean, I don't know if they're correct for sure, but you have, like, more data points saying that, like, oh, I really liked how this turned out. And for me as a coach, like, it was a lot about, like, watching the players grow. Like, you have a lot of sense of pride that you don't have as a player, right? Like, as a player, you're like, oh, like, I did this, blah, blah, blah. Like, you, some ego thing. But, like, as a coach, like, you can watch your players grow and become these things. And it's nice to watch that, I guess.
The other thing as well, I know I'm like raking up the old narrative here, but I'll do it anyway, is obviously you came from the fucking infamous Cloud Nine, which is the super throw team, and like the one that would be like really good in the middle, medium sized tournament, but then wouldn't win the biggest one, et cetera, right? In theory now, none of that's to do with Aoi now. Like, I think people already gave you the credit when you got the EG win, but like, at the time, people made out like that entire team were all just chalkers, like destined to lose or whatever. Like, it's kind of cool that you've won all these big championships since.
Yeah, a lot of second places on Cloud9, a lot of chokes in finals, so it is for sure nice. I think the thing is, like, how Dota works, maybe all esports or just in general, is, like, there's so much cumulative knowledge from those times, all those losses, like, it all led me here, right? Like, I channel a lot of what I've lost in the past in order to execute, like, current day stuff, so I'm really grateful I could have those experiences to lead me to this one.
I saw, like a bit like earlier, where you actually said, it's quite cool, by the way, that the first person to win two TIs is the one who actually is like, you know what? TI can be quite a lot about luck. And, you know, there's all other elements, like, because you're the one who can actually get away with saying that, mate. You've won it twice, because a lot of other people, like, this is the problem. I feel like part of why that narrative isn't said as much, at least in interviews, is because people all want to believe every win was super legit and that, like, everything they did in their life led them to that moment. They all want to believe that in every TI. They want to believe that they were the best team in the world if they win, right? But it actually takes some balls to sort of admit there's a lock element. I mean, I saw you even said, like, for you actually said you think hard work is the more important quality than talent. That's a pretty interesting statement.
I would think that. I mean, I've seen there's been, like, you could just do a data study on this, right? Like, you put a bunch of athletes, you give them like a ranking or like a power rating, and you give people like 1% more luck on the scale, and like they'll show, like, throughout their performances, like, how many first-place finishes and stuff they end up with. And, like, it's just astronomical. So just, like, from a data standpoint, like, luck is super important. And then you go into, like, a real-life application where there are even more factors that you can get lucky in. I think it's even more apparent that, like, you do have to get lucky to succeed, and it is a big factor. But, yeah, I think, I don't know, I feel like people should just, like, it's just statistically, it's just like that. So people should understand that. And as far as a hard work over talent thing, I think, like, maybe I don't really know what talent is. Like, it's like a weirdly defined word, but like maybe like the ability to learn fast or something. I think it's important, but I think most players, like, I think especially this TI-11 Tundra, like these nines and skitters, snaking. Like, snaking was actually a player I played on with my first Dota on Pot and Bottom in 2012, and he's been grinding for 10 years. Without, like, he hasn't had any real success. He won a Valve Miner, which didn't get paid out. Nice one. unlucky. And, like, this is his first real, like, TI success since 2012, grinding it out for 10 years. He's always been, like, on some, like, random NA teams, and he's just kept up the hard work. Like, and the thing is, when I talk to Snaking, like, I know he's talented, but it doesn't really, like, it didn't really show in his results. But the hard work persevered, and then, right? And now he's like a TI champion. That's why I think the hard work and perseverance will always come.
Yeah, when you say it like that, actually, that is the puzzle, isn't it? Because most people, everyone throws these terms around constantly in sentences, like we're all supposed to know what it means. But I get the feeling the word talent means many different things to different people. Like, I think to fans, dude, they just literally think like it's like raw mechanical skill or something. But as you say, to some, I don't think they know, for example, like, I don't know the guy personally, but I would almost guarantee if I look at his career, Arteezy must have fucking grinded a billion hours in a Dota.
For sure.
Like, just look at his longevity. Look how many different heroes he can play in all the positions. Like, and every different team, you can change any teammates around him, he's still just as good. Like that, I think people are taking it and they're almost acting like it's almost a bit childish, but they think like the really skilled person doesn't have to practice that much. It's like some kid's dream of like, if you're really good, you get like the B+ without having to do any homework or something, you know, like, but definitely the top players are all putting mad hours into.
I mean, it's probably the person who, like, he would naturally get a high mark, but he like works so hard on it anyways, right? I guess like you never really see that hard work aspect of it. So it's easy to. But I think it's the same in sports, like any competition in the world. Like at the professional level for anything, it's the people who are already super good who also put the insane hours. Like, you look at someone like Kobe, right? Like, I know he would, like, go into the practice 2 hours early before all his professional teammates. And he would practice 2 hours earlier, and he would leave later than not. And, like, that's the sort of work ethic that I think... I don't know if a lot of these players went in intentionally with this work ethic to be as professional, because, you know, basketball is more developed. But, for example, like, Arteezy, like, I was there when he was practicing all his laning mechanics with Bone 7 and Envy. Like, they all learned it together, Clairvoyance, too. That the four of them grinded out the mechanics, and for a while, he was by far the best laner. And it wasn't because he had some talent for it. Maybe he's smart, so he could learn faster. He's talented, so he has some ideas or whatever it was, but he put in the work to get this good. And that's the thing that really matters at the end.
Dude, that's also pretty wild when you say those names. And I'm just thinking, like, fuck, so if I go back and I get that team that was like RTZ, Eternal Envy, fucking Bone 7,
yeah.
Like, you're the one with the two TIs. Like, all right, mate, that fucking worked out pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, RTZ, there's like a famous tournament like in MLG Columbus 2013, Speed Gaming, where RTZ came and stood in for us.
Yes.
For me, that's actually still my personal favorite tournament.
Ah, right.
Because, like, the storylines for that were just
so
insane.
It was
so
impossible,
like,
to win, right? Yeah.
It was, we had 0-4 in the first day, our manager was scamming us, like, and then we end up, like, coming back, and we beat, like, some legendary DK team, but yeah, I guess that's why this TI doesn't seem as hype, right? Like, a tournament like MLG Columbus, the storyline is what makes it so legendary, whereas this TI for us, I don't feel like there's as much of a storyline.
Sure.
I'm unlucky. But yeah.
By the way, along these lines as well, another thing I wanted to ask was, when you think of, like, that aspect of, like, talent, hard work, if you look at your career, would you say were you one of the harder workers of the people you've been around?
Depends at times. Like, it varies, right? Based on my mental state, I think. And also, like, based on my, like, physical state, because I had some arm problems. But
how
I think,
did you,
like,
manage that when you're actually playing, by the way? Because obviously the problem with the RSI or anything like that is, when you're doing well, you're going to say, well, fuck it, I'll just fucking tank it and just hope I do well. But if the results are bad, you're going to want to rest it, etc. And the one thing I always say, the problem with those injuries, if people don't know, is most of them can be reversed and healed. But the number one thing is, don't play the game. That's what they always tell you. And that's the one thing you can't do. Exactly. That's the one thing a pro gamer can't do. He's got to play this game tomorrow or in a week, hasn't he? Yeah, exactly.
I actually had a physiotherapist say to me, that's like, oh, how much do you plan to compete? I'm probably like 10, 12 hours a day. He's like, oh, can you do less than that? I'm like, no. He's like, okay, you're going to keep having to keep come to us for treatments because, like, you know, like, you just have to play less. I think you're right. Like, that contributed to my mental state and a lot of the past teams I've been on. Like, when you're doing bad and your arm hurts, you're just, I don't really feel the grind, you know, the fire to grind it out. But I think also, like, how I... There's, like, a few players. Like, almost every single player in Dota exclusively learns to solo kill or team. And I think I'm one of the only Dota players that plays some party kill, like, with friends and stuff. And you can take, like, some ideas from these games. I think, actually, Anna, who also won 2 TIs, is one of them.
Right.
But he just, like, plays some party kill. You learn some, like, weird ideas because you're just... The environment's different, so you have, like, a unique perspective. But, like, how I practice, it's very different than other people, I think. Like, how I think about the game, how I talk about the game. And I think that's actually provided me with a lot of value throughout my career, to be able to come in with a more unique perspective. That being said, I think you'd have to play some solo queue. Like, I probably need to play more throughout my career. And, like, recently I have played more. Even as coach, I played a lot of solo queue, keep up with the game. But yeah.
One thing I wondered about is, I know another thing that makes esports really different compared to sports is obviously the timeline of when people are on top and how quickly you can drop in video game sports is way quicker than real sports. Like, you know, in real sports, like, you can have just one team be on top for 5 years. You can have one player be the best player for 15 years, 10 years if it's an amazing player. But obviously the ups and downs are crazier in esports. Like, what I always wonder about is, like, family and people who don't actually watch the game actively, because, like, if you've won all those years ago and you're having the success then, I'll bet in the years in between, and when they're checking in, they're sort of like, oh, it's not going that well. I didn't do, like, this must be pretty cool to win the world championship all these years later and sort of show you weren't just wasting your time the last few years, right? They must have wondered.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, I had already won some stuff, so it wasn't like a big, like, oh, you're wasting your time doing this. Also, it's like, the thing is, in esports, like, even if you're not winning all the time, like, if you have a good org and a decent team, like, you are making good salary. And
sure.
Even if, like, the thing is, like, I think, like, 9th through 10th, both at TI 10 was still, like, $1 million or something.
That's pretty amazing.
You're losing this tournament, but you're still getting $1 million as a team. Yes. It's like you failed. You failed into $200,000 a player, right? Which is like that's a lot of money for like what it is, right? For one tournament. So I don't think I really had to deal with those struggles as much, but I can see that a lot in like other esports where it's a lot more like, you know, the prize money is not good, and like if you're not on a top team, then you're still having to grind. I don't know. It was like that for me when I first started playing, I think. My parents were pretty against me playing video games instead of like focusing on university. And I won like some small local StarCraft tournament, made some money there, and I'm like, oh, cool. And then like I started getting more involved in it, and they're like, oh, I told them I want to take a break to play, and they're like, okay, as long as you have like a backup plan with university and stuff. And then I happened to have a good year with Cloud9 that year, so it made it really smooth.
Are they impressed with how long your career has lasted? Because there's another thing. I mean, people's careers can be over in a couple of years.
I mean, I've never talked to them about that, but I think the thing is, people's careers can be over in a couple of years, but I think we're just like at the forefront of esports, right? Like this is sort of the new era where I think people are staying longer. Like look at Faker. The guy's been on top of League of Legends for like an insanely long time. And I think League of Legends is way more mechanically like, like Twitch mechanics intensive than Dota is, right?
Yes.
So like hypothetically, you would need to be younger in League for the reflexes or whatever it is. But Faker is on like, he's at the top, right? Second place at Worlds or whatever after so many years. It's the same in Dota. Like my team's a bit older than past TI winners, I think. Like Snaking's actually the oldest person to win TI ever, like for the first time. Okay. And it's sort of showing that there is longevity in the scene. And, you know, I think it'll continue to improve.
I've got a weird question for you, right? If for some reason, so you can imagine, I don't make it like a fucking TV series or a movie where this, you know, you have like a time travel element. If we went back in time and I could give you like every kid's dream, like you could just live your life over again. So we're going to do your daughter career over again. Like, this is my question, right? What position would you play? If you could start the whole thing again. So like, obviously you can't, like, we're not going to make it ridiculous. Like you don't literally know every match that's going to happen. Cause obviously everything you do differently would change everything. Right. Like would you do anything different in your career? Like, would you just try and only be a one position player and be the champion of that? Would you just start support and say, fuck it. Like, I know this is already the role for me. What would you do?
So, well, I played a lot of Dota and Dota 1, right? And I was like a pub star back then. Like I would grind. I was like rank one on all the pub leaderboards and stuff. And I played carry back then, sort of. There weren't really roles in Dota 1.
Sure. It was mostly like, a pick-up game thing if people don't know. Yeah. It was just for fun. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there was like some competitive scene, but it was like mostly in China and like some Europe and stuff. But like when I came into Dota 2, I came in as a carry. I think it was actually a really good foundation of a skill set. I feel like it's actually hard to play support as first role. I think you sort of want to learn a lot of the mechanics of the game from a core perspective and a transition to support where it's a lot more knowledge. Maybe it's changed a bit now. But I feel like there are a lot of elements that are still like that. Like, this guy who came from Heroes of the Storm, Ari, he was like rank one in Heroes of the Storm, so the UK and Europe, and he transitioned Dota. He's been doing really well. He was on Into the Breach, now he's on TSM.
Okay.
But he had like the mechanical base from playing these other games to come in as a support, I think. I think that's like a big thing. Like, you need some sort of mechanical base, Dota, a different game, whatever it is, and then you can play support and like build your knowledge through that and play.
One thing I saw was very interesting because you did like an AMA not that long ago and I went and read a bunch of the things. I saw you made a very interesting comment on Poppy that I want to ask about in kind of a bigger picture about like the five position players basically, which is I noticed the way you complimented him was really interesting because you said that he very rarely makes spellcaster mistakes and that this is the key line you said. You said he always gets his own game to play even from position five. And I've noticed that's also another reason why I think those like captains from that role are so legendary because obviously that's like the most shit role in theory in the game to play and you're getting the least resources, but like if you can somehow be relevant, like that's amazing. It's something people saw on those OG teams, some of that was like miraculous shit sometimes, either B in the game and then B sometimes from that position. It's just don't fuck up, you're not making the big game winning play, just don't fuck up, right? That's there's a lot. I feel like there's, can you break that down a bit, because I feel like there's a lot more nuance there than a fan might understand.
Sure. So I think by not messing up your spells, I think a lot of it is about rushing. I think we talked before about like, oh, you're like looking to win the tournament. You're like, oh, we need to do this now. We need to do this now. You're like feeling like some urge there. Felt like when I watch Puppy, he's never like, oh, this needs to happen now. Like if I miss an opportunity, which will happen all the time in Dota, you will always miss opportunity no matter how good you are. He'll just wait for the next one. And same applies in team fights. Like he's always patient with when he goes in. He doesn't like, oh, I want to stun this guy now. So I go in, oh, I'm dead. Because like I went out of position. Like he'll always wait for his opportunity. And the other thing is, this is Team Secret style, where like Puppy will be able to be given some resources, even though he's on 5, to enable his own game, so he can then give back to the team. So that's also like a key facet of the 2019 Secret style, is like there's a lot of rotation between where cores go and when supports take lanes. And this allows the supports to have a lot of impact, because I mean, honestly, Puppy's like a 5 player, but he's sort of a 4. Like, his 4s have always placed more wards in him and bought more sentries. And he's always playing like the lane pusher heroes, so he's always like higher and farmed. But it's still like really impressive to watch him after so many years. He has so much success doing this.
Is there a player, because obviously, like, the interesting thing I actually thought about this part of the interview, like I said, was when I look back, I actually thought, because you'd be on all different teams, I thought you would have had way more teammates. When I looked, like I say, it was the same two cores of players, and sometimes they even mixed over depending on when you were coaching or playing in the last years. So a question I would have, because there's so many players have come and gone that you haven't played with, is there a player in the last like 4 or 5 years you'd love to have teamed with that you never played with?
Like as a player or as a coach?
As a player.
As a player? Like for anyone, I didn't think everyone would have wanted to play with like Miracle. I got to play with Peak Sumail, but I think Peak Miracle is the other. I think those two had the highest overall peaks in Dota, like where they were that much better than everyone. I think personally, like I think Sumail's peak was the highest, just because other people were worse. But Miracle peaked when other people were better.
Oh, it was incredible, yeah.
Yeah, and then I think it's just. And then I would have, I mean, if I got to play with like a Puppy or a No-Tail, like it would have been really cool to learn from. Like, I think it really elevates your idea of Dota. Like we mentioned before, like how Dota's really caged off. And that's why like the original Team Secret lineup was Fly, No-Tail, Puppy, S4, and Kuroki.
Yes.
And you can see how these 5 players have gone on to create like basically dynasties, right?
Yes.
And it's just all off, like they probably combined ideas on this one team and then they branched out. So that was like sort of an insane idea that like, because of how cagey the scene is with information, that you have such influence on the scene by making this one team that, honestly, the first Secret didn't really have success. So.
No, I always think, dude, especially like that lineup they had where they had the summer wins and the TI you were talking about, the TI you won. I always thought if that team had actually won that TI, all of history just changes. Like how people make
teams. Of course,
teams.
Yeah.
Oh, everything would be different, wouldn't it? That would be the craziest result you could make.
That's how TI works. If a different team wins, then everyone else is shuffling, so it's going to change.
Yes. By the way, another thing is as well, along those lines, is there actually like, did you ever have a big move or like an invitation to a team where like you didn't take it and you like, I could have done that, or I was thinking about it, but I decided against it. Was there any like big one that you haven't told about before maybe in past?
Oh, I think I mentioned this, but just in passing, like after TI5, I got invited to the Monkey Business team that became OG.
Oh, right. Okay.
With Fly, No-Tail, Miracle, and
why did you turn that down, then?
Yeah, I turned that down, and they got Jerix, which worked out better for them. But I want to play with Bulba and Yawar and like some boys in DC that I had some like then. And like obviously I can come back and look at it now and be like, oh, that was a dumb decision. But honestly, maybe it would have been the other way, where like this team would have succeeded a lot without me. And that team would have flubbed. Like I don't really think like hindsight and history works that way, where like you just replace one player and like the history will be the same just with. But you know, it's nice to think about.
By the way, since the thing you've stressed in this interview, I know this is something you believe in Dota, is this idea of like accumulating knowledge and understanding of the game and like a worldview on Dota, as it were. Are you looking forward to, because it can't be that many years until surely the coaching will just be like you versus Poppy versus fucking Kuroki. Surely it'll just be all these guys. I mean, Joey, it's already doing it. It'll just be all the great captains as the coaches that you'll be battling, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think there's just so much to learn in Dota. Like for me, like I think Dota of the like, top in esports, because I don't know the other games, but I think it's by far the most complex. Yes. And it's not necessarily like a positive or like some arrogance thing to say. It's just super complex and a lot of stuff to learn. And when there's that much to learn, you just get so much wrong all the time that you need so much experience of getting it wrong in order to build up this knowledge game and have a view. So I think, yeah, eventually it will be like that, because I think it's starting to get that point with coaches where you're having real coaches now. It's not like some. Like, personally, for me, I think, like, so I play a lot of pubs, and at some points during my team, I was really high ranked. Like, I was higher ranked than some of my players, because I think, like, need to have this understanding. And if you have a good understanding of Dota, then it's going to reflect in your rank. Dota's a game where, like, if you understand the game, it doesn't matter that much if you're worse mechanically, you can just outthink them. So I think it's sort of gone with the era where you'll have these like really low MR coaches for Dota. Like they might be good like mental coaches or analysts or whatever, because you can provide a lot of value with stats and stuff. But I think we'll start moving into like this, like with my rank, like I probably still could have played pro, but like I chose to coach. Like you have more of those people who are choosing to coach rather than I have to do this because I can't make it. Sure. And I think, you know, that's just a natural progression of the scene to have more spots to be more high skill.
Okay. One thing, that reminds me as well, the other thing I have to ask you about, obviously, is you are most famously, including in your TI win back in TI5, associated with techies. And I saw also, this is actually why I know you must be a legit person, because in theory, when it's your fucking hero, you're supposed to always go, no, it's not actually OP. Like, you know, you guys just don't know what you're doing or whatever. You even admit yourself, like, you should just be removed out of the game at this point in time, right?
Yeah, and it basically did. It got nerfed a lot or changed, reworked, but I don't know. Techies was not fun. Like, the hero was anti-fun at that time, right? And actually, you know, for TI11, like this current TI, we actually had an idea of picking techies. Like, it was going to be another five that we played, but people just end up giving up our heroes. Right. So that would have been fun. To like, oh, look, it's techies.
So people, you know, don't even know how bad it could have been. That would have been picked at, like, the finals.
Yeah, it would have been in the finals that we would have picked it, because we had some idea with this hero, but we didn't end up using that one. We didn't need to.
Right, at the end of this interview, do you have, like, a final message for people? Maybe you want to thank someone or say hello to someone?
No real shout-outs, but, like, I just want to thank, like, people for watching this. If you watch this, it seems like it was a very long interview, but thanks, and I appreciate it. Like, this scene is so cool, and I can't believe I can do this with my life, so just thank you for the support. It's only possible because of you guys. Yeah, thanks for taking the time to interview with.
Money doesn't grow on trees, and believe it or not, just watching a video for free with your dad doesn't really pay the bills. So thanks to the following people for kindly supporting my work and this particular content. And those people are, of course, Ahmed Hajou, Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Animosity, ButPounder420, Jensen Gore, Kovacevic, Tobias Bernasconi, Tosh, Toucan, and a special thanks always goes out to Jerky's Minion, my main man. You know what? There are plenty of perks to be found on my Patreon. Like, you can find out who upcoming guests are for my reflections, interviews, and talk shows. You can ask me a question in my monthly AMA. Might get roasted if it's a bit spicy in how you phrase it. You can figure out which pieces of content I might want to do next. I often ask people which they think between certain ideas, offer suggestions. You can even take part in one of those long discussions with me about all kinds of esports, whatever's on your mind. So if any of those sound like something that takes your fancy, put your money where your mouth is. Join the Scrumminati today via the Patreon link in the description below.